Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are very glad to have you with us. In our first hour today, we'll be spending some time talking about the ways that churches have contributed to the cause of racial justice and interracial understanding, or perhaps sometimes the way the churches have fallen short. And our guest for the program is John Nilsen. He is professor of theology at Loyola University in Chicago. Now, he will be here in our area in Champaign-Urbana to take part in an event toward the beloved community, the church's role in the struggle against racism. This is an evening program that will be taking place at St. Patrick's Parish Center at 708 West Main Street in Urbana tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in the evening. A number of churches in the area and other organizations are co-sponsoring. Also involved in this will be Bob McKim, who is currently the head of the Department of Religion at the University of Illinois, and Reverend Claude Shelby, pastor of the Salem Baptist Church. He's been a minister for a long time, has been at Salem since, I believe, 1981. And we were, in fact, planning on having him, that is Reverend Shelby, with us here in the studio this morning. He's had a little family emergency that he has had to respond to, and so we're sorry that he couldn't be with us today. But we do, of course, want you to know that he will be taking part in this event tomorrow night, and it is free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending certainly should feel free to stop by. It's one of the many events here in our area commemorating the 80th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., which is, in fact, actually today, January 15th. Our guest, John Nilsen, is talking with us by telephone, and certainly if you're interested in being involved in this conversation, we'd welcome your calls. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, you can call in and participate. I just do want to mention, among the many things that our guest has written, one book in particular that is out just recently that bears on this topic that we're talking about. It's titled Hearing Past the Pain Towards African-American White Catholic Theological Engagement. That book was published last year. In addition to his teaching responsibilities, our guest is a member of the Jewish Catholic Scholars Dialogue in Chicago, the Anglican Roman Catholic Consultation in the United States. He also serves on the editorial board of Theological Studies and has served as president of the Catholic Theological Society of America. And Professor Nilsen, thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David. Good to be here.
Just, and I suppose it's worth making the general point. I would assume that probably this is something that would certainly people would understand, but that in the struggle for civil rights in this country, churches have been very important, and certainly in the African-American community, churches were very important parts of organizing. It was a place where people came together, and certainly many important people who were leaders in the civil rights struggle, including, of course, Dr. King, were clergy. So you have to begin by making the point that in this struggle, churches have been and continue to be very important.
Absolutely, absolutely. When I'm thinking church, I'm certainly thinking of the institutions that you mentioned, their contribution. But I'm also thinking of my own church, the Roman Catholic Church, which I was born into, remain loyal to. I think our record is, unfortunately, a little more spotty. The subtitle of my book, it's Hearing Past the Pain, but the subtitle is Why White Catholic Theologians Need Black Theology. So a little more punchy than the old subtitle that you read.
That's something I definitely want to ask you about, because I know that you have written on that subject and have spoken on that subject. Let me just hold that for a moment.
Sure.
Just because I'm interested in a general comment about your feeling about how white Christians, not just necessarily Roman Catholics, but whether you feel that people of faith, white people of faith, and their churches stepped up to the plate when it came to issues of racial justice, and do you in fact think that somehow the Catholic Church even lagged behind other Christian denominations where the congregations were predominantly white?
To some extent, I think the Catholic Church has lagged behind, and part of that is due, at least in my view, to the fact that the Roman Catholic Church was for a long time very much an immigrant church. We were the people who came from elsewhere. We were the people who were uneducated. We were the people at the lower end of the economic spectrum. We often spoke a different language. And to some of the Protestant elite, we also owed our loyalties not to the government in Washington, but to the Pope in Rome. So there was a concern on the part of a great many Catholic leaders to demonstrate that, no, we're Catholics, but we're good Americans, too. We support the government. We support the policies. And so, consequently, there wasn't the kind of opposition to slavery that you found in church, in white churches that didn't have that immigrant burden to carry.
Mm-hmm. I wonder to what extent perhaps that also has something to do with the fact that through a good part of American history that Roman Catholics in the United States were a minority, and in fact, I don't know if it's going too far to say that they were an oppressed minority, but there certainly would have been times in America where Roman Catholics were thought of as being a kind of an, in the sociological sense, being an out-group.
Oh, definitely, definitely, definitely. I mean, we forget. I mean, you know, a convent was burned in Charleston. The Pope was, regularly made fun of in sort of mainline publications. Oh, yeah. I mean, to be a Catholic, and especially in the South, was definitely to be in a minority.
Hmm. Well, let me come to this point when you talked about the subtitle of the book, and I know that you've spoken on this very topic, that is, posing this rhetorical question, why white theologians need black theology. And I suppose then the question to ask is there a black theology? Is there a white theology? And in what way are they different?
Well, there certainly is a black theology. And the people who are most prolific in this particular area will trace the origins of black theology actually back to the enslaved Africans, that, you know, in the period of slavery, from the masters, they were given a version of Christianity that came down to obedience. You know, to be a good Christian means simply to do what your master tells you to do, and don't steal, et cetera, et cetera. But they also understood that wasn't the essence of Christianity. The essence of Christianity had to do with freedom. It had to do with justice. It had to do with their inherent dignity as children of God. Those are sort of the deep roots of black theology that people acknowledge today. It really begins more as a what can we say as a matter of books and articles and conferences and journals with James Cone in his book in the late 1960s that called Black Theology and Black Power. And that's where he sort of raised the battle cry, pointing out that, you know, by and large, Christian theology as it existed was ignoring the main issue of justice and oppression that existed in American society. He was pointing out that, you know, theology just wasn't theology, no matter, you know, who did it and from what particular social or racial perspective, but one's social location and racial perspective, and now gender, had a great deal to do with the way one saw these particular issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found myself, I feel I'm coming around in a circle here, but I guess now I find myself coming back to this question of how well the church, broadly speaking, does deal with issues like inequality, like injustice in society, like what is life like for those people who are at the bottom?
Well, I think that the churches still have not come to terms with the systemic nature of our social problems. That is to say, there's still too much of a tendency to look upon poverty and injustice as a matter for individual Christians to sort of change their hearts, change their consciences, and therefore change their ways of behavior. The church, it seems to me, needs to take a much more critical look at government policies, legal processes, social mores that already embody and carry forward, you know, systems of injustice that wind up leaving people, you know, at the bottom of the economic ladder. In other words, it seems to me the church is not only supposed to be calling people to conversion, but it also has to be a social critic as well.
Mm-hmm. And that it seems that particularly in the Catholic Church, this idea that it is the appropriate role, in fact, that the call that the church is called, that people of faith are called to be social critics and to address issues of social injustice. Now, this is something that certainly within the Catholic Church has been very controversial, and in fact, there have been times when the leadership of the church at the very top has made it very clear that they felt that this was not the appropriate role for the church, and has caused, I'm sure, a lot of friction, some places in the world at least, between clergy and people who were activists on the community level and the leadership of the church at the very top.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and probably Exhibit A in that respect is the fate of Latin American liberation theology.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think about that then? I mean, if you feel that, and you're not just sort of an average Catholic, you're somebody who is in an important position of thinking about these issues and talking about these issues and teaching on these issues. How do you think about that when you feel very strongly that there is this call in one direction and the leadership of the church is saying, well, you know, really what we're all about is saving souls. We're about spirituality. And we're not really sure that we want to go out there and take society and political leadership head on. I mean, how do you think about that?
Well, with a great deal of sometimes frustration and impatience. And certainly my role is, you know, I'm in the academy. You know, I'm not an activist. And so I consider my role to be more, as you mentioned, sort of behind the scenes, trying to think about these things, write about these things, publicize these things in the hope of helping people to take a different perspective. And one of the ways I would do that is to remind people that there's a strong strain, it seems to me, of individualism in American culture. We're sort of on our own. We're a bunch of lone rangers, and government is the result of a contract that whereby we agree to give away a certain degree of our freedom in order to gain certain benefits back. Whereas I think the Roman Catholic tradition is that we're all in this together. We depend upon one another, and we Catholics resonate very strongly with Dr. King saying we're caught up in an inescapable web of mutuality. And so to remind people that government policies, legal processes, et cetera, have a profound effect on each of us as individuals. In other words, I think there are tremendous resources in the Catholic intellectual tradition that can be brought to bear in the struggle for justice.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Nilsen. He is professor of theology at Loyola University in Chicago. And he will be here in our area tomorrow to take part in an event, The Church and the Struggle Against Racism. And the formal title, Toward the Beloved Community, The Church's Role in the Struggle Against Racism, taking place at St. Patrick's Parish Center on Main Street in Urbana tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Also taking part in this will be the Reverend Claude Shelby. He's the pastor of the Salem Baptist Church in Champaign, and we had planned on having him here with us today in the studio to contribute some of his thoughts to the conversation. Unfortunately, a little family emergency came up that he had to deal with, and we're sorry that he can't be here, but he certainly will be taking part in this event tomorrow night. So Anybody who is interested, really, we'd certainly encourage them to attend. And as I said, this is just one of the many events that will be taking place in our community to commemorate the birthday of Dr. King. Questions here on the program are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, what then if someone says, I recognize that what you say is certainly correct, and if they are a Christian, they feel called to be involved in this struggle, or at least to make a contribution, maybe at the very, very least to be thoughtful about it. So what is it that you suggest people do, actually, in terms of concrete action?
Well, that's a harder question. And I think before I would presume to answer that for anyone, I would want to ask them a number of questions about where they live, you know, what kinds of opportunities may or may not be available to them in terms of, you know, their work situation or their school situation or what have you. One of the problems with our society, one of the huge obstacles involved in grappling with these issues is the extent of residential segregation mm-hmm. in our society. I mean, now, of course, now we have laws that prohibit segregation in the way that, you know, segregation was allowed prior to the civil rights era. But now there's still a kind of residential segregation that takes place insofar as basically whites live with whites and blacks live with blacks. And so as Andrew Hacker, the sociologist, speaks about in his book, we're still kind of two nations, separate, hostile, and unequal. And so for many whites, what life is like in America for many black people is just sort of utterly off their radar screen. And so maybe, the first place to, point someone is maybe just to do a little reading, little listening to, again, get a sense of life, you know, for others whose skin color may be very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know this is something that you have written a lot about and spoken about. That is perhaps people's, for people like us, people who are white, our awareness of race as an issue is often pretty low. And yeah. That they would say something like, I guess I understand there's racism and that people of color face discrimination. But then they'd say, but really, what exactly has that got to do with me? Particularly if they like to think of themselves, well, I like to think of myself as a person of goodwill, you know, someone who sure. Bears malice toward none. You want to say, I think basically I'm an okay guy. So what has that got to do with me?
Well, I think one of the hardest things to face here in terms of the question you ask, what has that got to do with me, revolves around what's been called white privilege. And it's coming to the realization that the economic status that I might occupy, the achievements that I might have had in my life, the level of comfort and economic security that I have are not all due to my nobility and hard work. In other words, to take a hard look at our society and history is to realize that from the moment that Africans were first brought to this continent, they have been systematically discriminated against, and the flip side of that is that white people have been systematically advantaged. Okay, so for instance, the Homestead Act that was passed, you know, during the Lincoln administration, you know, allowing I forget how many acres of land. Black people, even though they were free, were excluded from that. You know, so in other words, a white European immigrant could take advantage of that. Blacks couldn't. OK. Okay? Many of the New Deal programs that did so much to bring people out of poverty and to move them into the middle class were also programs that, again, systematically excluded blacks. Now, that the political reality was such that Roosevelt had to agree, you know, to those conditions, or else the Southern, you know, the powerful Southern Democrats in Congress, you know, wouldn't do it. But the fact is that again, certain sectors of our population, people of color, you know, did not get the advantages that white people did. And that's a hard lesson because, you know, again, we like to think, well, you know, I did this, I accomplished this, et cetera, et cetera. To realize, well, no, the reality is a little more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. I'm just now, you know, curious over time as you have talked about some of these things and really talked about what is perhaps a broader way of thinking about racism in one's self and in society, how people react to that. As I know that you've not been shy in talking about this and advancing these ideas, and I'm sure that people have not been shy in telling you what they thought.
Well, that's a strange one for me, David. Frankly, I have not gotten any angry phone calls. I have not gotten a single piece of hate mail since I've begun talking about these things. And I've asked myself, why is that the case? And I think two reasons. One is that I think, you know, many people now realize that there are certain forms of racial expression that are just not acceptable anymore. I mean, the kinds of racial stereotypes that, you know, were quite commonplace in quote unquote polite society years ago, you know, just aren't anymore. So that may be part of it, but I think maybe the other part, and maybe this is too optimistic on my part, is that I like to think that at least much of what I'm saying is at least striking a chord in people. So that if their first reaction is, well, Nelson is nuts or you know, he's another one burdened with white liberal guilt, et cetera, maybe there's a second moment in which they've seen enough, they've heard enough to think, well, no, but maybe there's something to all this. Maybe there's something to all this.
Mm-hmm.
So...
So you may think at least maybe you've gotten a little bit past the point of people being shocked if you stand up and you say you know, something like, "Hi, I'm John Nelson. I'm a professor of theology at Loyola, and I'm a racist." And I'm sure that I don't know if you've ever actually said it like that, but I'm sure that suddenly, you know, that's, you're going to get people's attention. When you say, "Well, okay, hear me now. Hear what it is. Hear what I am saying."
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose at that point, then if people start thinking about it, they say, "Well, okay, I get your point," and probably will say, "Yes, I can see that, and I can see that how that applies to me too."
Well, I have said in public that I am a racist, and I've said that in front of my own professional organization. But I think another reason, perhaps, for not getting verbally violent reactions to anything I'm saying is that I don't feel like I'm preaching here. I feel like I'm saying, well, look, these are the historical facts. These are the sociological realities. This really happened. And so it's not a question of sort of arguing with Nelson is pushing a strange and controversial position. It's rather, we need to open our eyes. We need to open our eyes.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, maybe in fact sometimes the reaction would be initially for people to say, "Yes, I understand what you're saying. I see the point, and I acknowledge that, and now please go away and die. and let me get on with my life and the way that I've been living it. So, you know, quit bothering me with this stuff."
Right. Well, you know, yeah, that's probably true. Maybe the book would sell more if fewer people had that reaction.
All right. Well, I'd like to bring somebody here in the conversation, somebody who is in Champaign. This is line one.
Sure.
Hello.
Hello. This is fascinating. I just picked it up as I was driving into my garage, but I assume the topic is the relationship between the church, and I guess that means the universal church, including black churches, and social justice or racial justice in the United States?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
Indeed.
All right, I'm African-American. I guess that's a relevant point at this point. So I grew up in an AME church. I decided to venture into white, predominantly white churches because I was very saddened of the fact that the most racially segregated hour in this country at the time, and it still may be, is at 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings. That may still be the case, but I know it's pretty segregated now. I read a lot of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s comments about that, his letter from the Birmingham jail, when he was trying to deal with the issues of the white clergy especially. But I later found out even the black clergy was very much critical in some quarters about his quest for social justice for African Americans and later poor people. And I grew to a point where I became very cynical about organized religion, for lack of a better term, because I do think, as Dr. King once warned the black church, we're at the risk of becoming irrelevant social clubs. And I do believe, in terms of social justice, and I'm sort of being provocative, that I think the organized church, or the churches that spring up around this country and in this community, are, in my estimation, irrelevant social clubs. And very insular and pretty much unmindful of the social injustices that exist in this community and throughout the country. Will you respond to that?
Well, thank you for your comment. And there's a lot in what you say that resonates with me. And I think that in great part the reason for the insularity is again our residential segregation, that the churches are they exist in particular locales. They serve the people in those locales, and if the population is predominantly white, then it's going to be a predominantly white congregation with predominantly white preoccupations. So I think that it takes real leadership, you know, within those congregations to understand the blinders that the congregation may have simply in virtue of its social location and begin to look for opportunities to reach out beyond their geographical boundaries to work toward a more inclusive understanding and actualization of church, as you alluded to at the beginning of your comment.
Okay, thank you.
No, thank you. Well, we're just a little bit past our midpoint here, and perhaps I should introduce again our guest, John Nilsen. He's professor of theology at Loyola University in Chicago, and if you're interested in reading some of his writing on this very subject, you might look for a book that we have mentioned a couple of times. The title is Hearing Past the Pain, Why White Catholic Theologians Need Black Theology. It's published by the Paulist Press, and it's been out for just a couple of years. Our guest, John Nilsen, will be taking part in an event toward the beloved community, the Church's Role in the Struggle Against Racism. This will be taking place tomorrow night at St. Patrick's Parish Center on West Main Street in Urbana. It is co-sponsored by a number of area churches and other organizations. Responding to the initial presentation by Professor Nilsen will also be Professor Bob McKim, who is head of the Department of Religion at University of Illinois, and also the Reverend Claude Shelby. He's the pastor of the Salem Baptist Church in Champaign. And in fact, we had planned on having Reverend Shelby here in studio with us to be involved in this conversation here this morning, and we were sorry. He had a little family emergency he had to deal with, so unfortunately he couldn't be with us here. But he'll be taking part in this event. It is free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend is certainly welcome. That's tomorrow night. This is one of the events here taking place in the community to mark the birthday of Dr. King. Questions, other questions certainly are welcome. People want to be involved here in our conversation here this morning. We certainly welcome that. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. And we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And I believe next we'll talk with someone on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You spoke about the residential segregation. How do you justify or how do you comment on these large mega churches that are formed miles outside of neighborhoods on the fringes of towns, perhaps to gain these large spaces? spaces and large parking lots. They, I've heard them referred to as white flight churches. Any idea or comments on those?
I'm sorry, I didn't get your last.
And it's, he just said, would you have any thoughts to share or any comments to make about the general point?
Yes, about them referred to as white flight churches and,
right.
And how they're, we see these things springing up all across the country in different areas.
Yes, yes, we do. And, of course, right near us is Willow Creek Church, the mother of them all, as we say. I'm aware that there's a whole literature on these churches, and I'm not familiar with it. So this is probably not to be trusted. I do know, at least from the little I've read, that Willow Creek began when the pastor was given an assignment. Go set up a church there. And instead of, following sort of what was conventional practice, he rather, spent a lot of time going door to door and asking people what they really wanted in a church. And much of the church and its worship was designed, around the responses that he got. The so that, yes, in some cases, I suppose they might deserve the epithet white flight. On the other hand, I think there's some evidence that the leadership of these churches is beginning to take a broader view of their role and mission. And Pastor Rich Warren has been in the news very much insofar as President-elect Obama has chosen him to offer the prayer.
I'm thinking of
Church? Sorry. Okay, so I'm thinking of a remarkable interview that I read with Warren where he describes his awakening to the realities of injustice. And the phrase that from that interview that has stuck with me is his line. He says, "How could I have read the Bible for so many years and missed the hundreds of verses that have to do with the poor and the oppressed?" And that tells me two things. One is that how easy it is for our social location, our privileged status, to make us kind of deaf to some of the more demanding dimensions of our religious commitment. But then also, it suggests to me that if someone like Warren is beginning to, again, understand things in broader terms, then maybe these white flight churches, could become real resources in the struggle for justice.
You're referring to Rick Warren of the Brokeback Church?
Yes. Saddleback, is that it? In California. Again, the man who's going to offer the prayer at the inauguration.
Yeah, I think common stance.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good day.
All right, well, thank you. Well, just for a moment, I'm continuing to think about the comments of the first caller who made the point. And I'm sure people have made it before him about how on a Sunday morning when people go to worship, this may be one of the most segregated times in America because churches are stratified. There's sectarian divisions. There are racial divisions. I'm sure that there are class divisions. As somebody who I'm thinking about your thoughts on this, as somebody who has been involved in some kinds of interfaith dialogue kinds of efforts, what you do about that to try to get people to mix it up a little bit, in the context of worship perhaps or church activities, how do you create opportunities for different kinds of people to come together?
Well, one of the factors about American religion is that it exists in a consumer culture. Nobody has got a gun to your head to force you to go to church on Sunday. So that it seems that for many, many people, there's sort of an implicit demand for a certain level of comfort. In other words, they're not going to go to church on Sunday to be made to feel guilty or uncomfortable or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So simply to you know, sort of pound the pulpit and, you know, take a, you know, a consistently challenging, demanding approach, you know, I don't think is going to get very far. It has to be put in the context of the Christian message, which is also, you know, a message of love and acceptance and, you know, our common humanity as children of God, and to understand that these challenges, you know, need to be addressed not simply because it's the right thing to do, but because it also leads to a deeper realization of the meaning of our own discipleship and the richness of our own humanity.
Uh-huh.
So it requires, it seems to me, it requires a very sensitive, a very intelligent, and very attractive kind of leadership, which, you know, may not be in great supply in many congregations.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Bloomington, Indiana, next, line two. Hello.
Hi. You know, I know that Christianity has been blamed for tolerating slavery, tolerating racial discrimination. But I think Christianity can also take credit for the success of the civil rights movement. You know, Dr. King was the Reverend Dr. King. He was a Christian minister, and the civil rights movement was organized and run by Christians, both black and white Christians, mostly out of black churches. And also, when Americans saw peaceful civil rights workers murdered, peaceful civil rights workers attacked, civil rights workers, police dogs turned on them, fire hoses turned on demonstrators. It was Christian moral outrage, which forced politicians to pass laws that they didn't want to pass. If you remember that history, the politicians were not eager to pass those civil rights laws. It was the American moral consensus, and it was a Christian moral outrage that forced them to do it. I believe it was Christian moral consensus that produced the Civil Rights Revolution.
Well, I would certainly agree with you about the incredible role of the black churches, and unfortunately, that story, I think, is not well known enough. I absolutely agree with you on that, and there is no civil rights movement without the Christian churches. But when I think about my own church, as I mentioned before, the Roman Catholic Church, I think our record is somewhat more spotty, And I think, you know, in my own tradition, we have resources of people and thought that still have been tremendously underutilized in the struggle for racial justice.
Well, we can still do better, can't we?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the statistics today about what we might call quality of life statistics and how on practically every measure, you know, blacks are much worse off than whites, you say, yes, we're not in a post-racial society by any stretch, no matter who is being inaugurated next Tuesday.
No, but you know it's going to be a... it's going to be a great thing. Yeah, I don't agree with the president-elect, but I will rejoice that a black man has become president of the United States. I think that's wonderful.
Oh, I do too. I do too. I just am saying it's you know, the millennium doesn't start next Tuesday.
No.
When he puts his hand on the Bible.
All right. Well, I thank you for the comments. Let's continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line three. Hello.
Fascinating topic, and I think on a pretty good day, Martin Luther King's birthday actually is on this day.
Yes.
I grew up in the South, and of age that when you think of the civil rights movement in this country, I mean, you think of the black church. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I think today the black church has lost some of that, but I do agree with the gentleman from Bloomington, Indiana. I hope that I never forget, and I just want to bring some people along with me, that it wasn't just black churches that were active in the civil rights movement. a lot of white churches were, and ministers and people of faith and religion were involved in that movement. And many of them, much like black people, died. They gave their lives for it. I think what bothers me today when I look at what has come forward from all churches, and it goes back to another comment that was made, the most segregated moment or an hour in our country happens on Sunday morning. And to me, that is just a little bit sad. And there is room for more improvement, but not only just racial inequality, but I also think about people who have different sexual preferences. All of us are God's people, I'd like to see more done on that front also.
Well, again, I thank you for the comment. I don't know, Professor Nilsen, you want to respond to that? Or you respond in any way you like?
Well, yes, I just maybe briefly. I think we're certainly right to emphasize the role of the Christian churches, and in particular Dr. King as a preacher. I mean, he always identified himself as such, and that's absolutely correct. But in honoring him today, I think one significant dimension of his achievement is that he was able to articulate the resources of the Christian tradition in a way that connected them with the American dream. A couple of callers have referred to his letter from Birmingham City Jail. That is a masterpiece, because the way he says our struggle for justice is in fact the American struggle. In other words, the way he frames it is this: that if you are opposed to the black struggle for justice, you're not a good American. That was a remarkable piece of work, and I think a dimension of Dr. King's achievement that also needs to be held up.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest for the program is John Nilsen. He's professor of theology at Loyola University in Chicago. He is going to be here in our area tomorrow night to give a talk and participate in an event talking about the role of the church in the struggle against racism. And questions are certainly welcome. We have a couple of people here standing by. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Just at least in passing, I feel that we have to also acknowledge the fact that if you look at white people of faith who were involved in the civil rights struggle, we have to very strongly acknowledge the fact that there were a lot of Jewish people involved in that. And in fact, if you think about them as a percentage of the population, it was certainly very significant compared to white Christians who were involved in the movement. Not saying that there weren't white Christians, but we've been talking a lot about Christians and civil rights, and I feel like really we have to say this was not just Christians. I'm sure that there were a lot of people of other faith, but certainly a very significant contribution of people who were Jewish.
Absolutely.
Well, let's go and talk with someone else, and I think that our next caller will be in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Thank you, David, for your previous comment. That's one of the points I wanted to make. There were Jews who gave their lives during the civil rights movement. My understanding of some of the history of, I'm not Jewish, but I was intrigued to learn that Jews were seen as outside the, pale, I guess, is maybe one of the terms one might use, and peddlers at one period in American history were often Jewish because they were discriminated against and had difficulty establishing stores. Eventually they did in many small towns, but their customers were often African Americans and they often brought goods and news to African American communities, is my understanding. But the other thing I wanted to say was that one of the strains in Christianity is I'm better than you are because I'm saved and I believe in Jesus, and the only way that you can be saved and you can be a good person is if you believe in Jesus. And while I can understand where that comes from, and certainly not everybody takes that attitude, and I'm emphasizing it here, but it really is, can be a really nasty sort of attitude, that if you are not a Christian, you're not good because you will be going to hell, and you're stupid for not believing in Jesus. I find it really offensive, and I don't know what the way is around it. Some denominations and many Christians don't actually feel that way, but often if you go, for instance, to a Christian funeral, that's what you hear, and the subtext is nobody else is going to be, we've got it over everybody else. And it's not solely the province of Christians or any particular religious group. Muslims probably feel the same way about people who don't believe as they do. I don't know about Hindus, but I think it's one of the major faults of many religious groups and one of the major sources of conflict in this world. Any comments?
Well, all I can say is, the attitudes and the convictions that you reported are not the attitudes and convictions of the Roman Catholic Church, you know, to which I belong. It's certainly not also the attitudes or convictions of the Episcopal Church in this country, as I've come to understand it, and many other Christian groups. But at the same time, what you report, yeah, I'm aware that many there are people that say that and people that operate that way. But in my own view, those sorts of behaviors and those sorts of convictions are absolutely antithetical to what Christianity is really about.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We have a number of others, and we're very short on time. Maybe we have about 5 minutes, so I'd like to go and try to include some others and go next to Champagne, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello, is that line number two? Am I on?
Yes.
Hi, thanks for the great program. Of course, Dr. King stood for justice and freedom for all people. So I was wondering if your guest could comment on the attitudes and convictions of the Catholic Church in America in relation to the recent conflict of the occupied territories in Gaza. And I think the church in Europe quite rightfully condemned this as a race struggle, you know, of Zionism. I was wondering what is the position of the Catholic Church in America on that particular issue. So, and then also wanted to, if you have time, ask him to reflect about the link between black theology and, of course, liberation theology in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'll hang up on the radio.
Well, certainly the second point is something that you did talk about a little bit earlier, and you certainly can address that again, or the comments, the question the caller asked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what's going on now, you can take that on any way that you like.
And I really won't. I know that a debate has already developed, and I haven't kept up with it. I think it would be irresponsible for me to make any comment about that. But as far as the relationship between black theology and liberation theology is concerned, in my view, black theology is a liberation theology, and very often Gustavo Gutierrez of Peru is honored as the father of liberation theology, and without in any way denigrating from Father Gutierrez's accomplishments, I think James Cone also deserves that title as well, because, as I mentioned, his book, Black Theology and Black Power, came out even a little bit before Gutierrez's book did in the United States. They are the two founders of liberation theology.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time. Real quick, though, we'll try to get someone in here in Savoy. Line three. Hello.
Yes. Hi. I turned in late to the program today, but I did pick up many interesting points from, well, both you, David, and the professor from Loyola. And, you know, in the last couple of years or so, I have read a few articles that compare the struggle of the African American to be free and have rights in this country to the pro-life movement, you know, that claims that the preborn is not considered, I mean, they don't claim, but the opposite, the pro-choice people, or maybe legislation maybe puts it this way, that they're not a person and they don't have rights. I don't know if you have time to comment, but I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
And I can give you what is a very difficult, complex question. I could probably give you about 30 seconds.
Well, I'm aware of that particular approach that's being taken in the pro-life movement. I myself am a little bit leery of it. The more history I read, the more aware I am of the complexity of the issues, even as they were debated around the time of the Civil War. And it strikes me that pro-life can make its case without necessarily moving in this other direction.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that with, again, a reminder to people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana that you'd like to hear more on this subject, take part in an event. This will be the central issue of an event taking place tomorrow night in Urbana toward the beloved community. The church's role in the struggle against racism takes place at St. Patrick's Parish Center, 708 West Main Street in Urbana at 7 o'clock. Our guest, John Nilsen, professor of theology at Loyola University in Chicago, will be speaking, as well as the Reverend Claude Shelby, pastor of Salem Baptist Church. We hope to have him with us here this morning, and something came up and he couldn't be with us, but he will be taking part in the event. It's free and it's open to the public. One of the things going on here to commemorate the birthday of Dr. King, which is in fact today. And to you, Professor Nilsen, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
David, thanks for having me.